Nice.
So, okay, so, and that should be streaming on the online.
Yeah, yeah.
So everything set up, let's go. Okay, so gamification is this epic review.
Yeah. Alright, so yeah, this is the paper I'm going to be presenting. Gamification and serious games within the domain of domestic energy consumption, a systematic review. So they reviewed a set of carefully selected papers with a well-defined process. They've selected databases, selected the keywords to do the search, and then they've selected how they're actually going to select the papers from the search results and how they're going to review and extract the data from each of the papers and then present the results and discuss on them. And so their focus is on serious games and gamification that intend to influence external behavior related to energy conservation. And what they're looking at is, has previous research, do they have sufficient evidence that serious games and gamification can actually have an influence on this energy conservation behavior? And in domestic domains, so household electricity usage. So their research question is the following, and they talk a lot about applied games, and by that they mean serious games and the use of gamification. And to be a little bit more specific, they are interested in both efficiency gains and actual energy reduction concerned with electricity usage at homes. And I think they motivated their research quite well. So it starts with the issues related to climate change and energy production, as well as scarce resources and a growing middle class in developing countries, which are becoming really, they said in the paper, hungry for energy consumption. So that really brings a need to reduce domestic energy consumption, which according to the paper is an important target group, and it's been rising. And human behavior here is in a key role. And latest trends have been to use serious games and gamification to influence this behavior. So obviously it's quite important to see if the use of the serious games and gamification is actually efficient. And this is what the paper aims to do. And they have a quite well-structured structured their methods to perform the review. So they started with by defining the review protocol, which is based on the Prisma checklist. And as if I understood correctly, this is like a guideline how to perform the systematic review. So the rest of their methods is based on this protocol. And they started with setting criteria of how to choose or not to choose the papers from their search results. And one interesting thing that came out here was that papers other than English language were not included in the search, but they also acknowledged this fact later in the limitations. Otherwise, I think they were quite clear. Then they looked at the databases that they're going to use. So they used mostly electronic databases to find the papers, but also they looked at a few key papers, looked at the reference lists from those to find some more papers. They said that they identified the databases which were relevant to certain topics such as information technology, social science, interaction design. But it was, I think, a little unclear then how the databases were actually chosen, which ones they took and which ones not. Then they did the actual search from the databases, chose keywords that they did the search with. They presented the keywords that they use and the combinations, and which ones they left out. And then the study selection was a big part of this review. So they found about 2,500 papers from which to select more papers. And first they looked at the title of the papers to take out most of them. Then they checked the abstract and then finally the full papers. And here I think it was interesting that this was performed only by one researcher. So that's something to be careful with. But it was also checked by a few others then later on the results that the first researcher found. Then they ended up with 25 papers from which to actually collect the data and review them. And they had a well-defined process here. They had a data extraction paper, which they had developed based on some previous work. And then one researcher, again, read the papers and extracted all the necessary information onto the paper. And they, again, defined this process quite well. They had not piloted it. They told how they developed the extraction paper and that they didn't contact the authors of the papers for more information. So I think overall it was well explained. Then they did some game classification, quality assessment. I think the quality assessment was also interesting. So they assessed all of the papers. They had some quality assessment criteria based on some previous work in similar review. It was done by two of the researchers, and it's quite prone to some subjectivity. So I think you should be careful looking there at the quality assessment. And actually, are they, what is the standard of the quality of all the papers? So they separated them, some of them low quality, some of them high quality, but I mean, overall, are they at the low end or the high end? And then they compared all of the results that they had gained. It was through informal discussion and looking at the patterns. But yeah, the paper, I think it was well-structured and it was really easy to follow the whole process. And you had quite good level of confidence that you could actually repeat this whole process. And then there are results and discussions. So 25 papers they reviewed overall out of approximately 2,500 they identified. And from the 25, they then collected the data. And they presented in different tables and structured the results with the data and the items they collected. So for example, they collected sample size, sampling methods, different game elements that were used. And they talked about the results in these sections. This was one of the tables that related to the study outcomes results, which I think was quite interesting to pick out. So as you can see, for example, the behavior, the external behavior change, only 10 of the papers assessed this one. So what this means is I mean, the external behavior, do the studied participants actually save energy during or after the intervention? And most of the papers measured this by metering systems, so they actually got data of what the electricity usage at the households were. And a few of them did this by self-reporting styles. But for the other papers that actually didn't assess the external behavior, the other important ones were the cognitive and aspects and then the knowledge gains. But I think you should also be careful with those as the paper pointed out really well all the limitations. So for the papers they reviewed, they had a lot of problems with sampling methods and sampling size. So most was done with convenience sampling, and data was gathered with surveys. So I think for the cognitive aspects, which means that have the participants actually changed their attitudes towards energy conservation. So if the participants were sampled by convenience sampling and then the data was gathered by surveys, I think it could be quite biased. So you have to be careful with those. And does it actually mean that if they change their attitudes towards energy conservation, do they actually change their behavior? Or do they just say they do? The same goes with knowledge. So if they actually say that they learned about how to conserve energy, will they actually conserve it later on? And then about this one, the study outcomes, they divided into positive, mixed, and negative. So also maybe slightly unclear of how they grouped them into positive, mixed, or negative, but how I understood it was if the reviewed paper presented the results and found some positive trends, then it would go into the positive. But it's the results were really varied in the papers they reviewed. And this is apart from their discussion section, so they were quite careful in conducting or generalizing anything, as they acknowledged that the papers they reviewed were really, a lot of them they said were low quality and had a lot of different issues that they pointed out. For example, sample size, poorly described methodologies, absence of controls, no worries, narrow data collection timeframes, and that most of the papers they reviewed were exploratory in nature. So this also means that the results they actually present are not that, I mean, high quality either, so you have to be careful with them. But I think they did well because they didn't seem very biased in this, and they really pointed out well all the limitations and that the papers had. They also pointed out their own limitations of the study. Search terms, they left some, for example, play, and a few other keywords. So they mostly focused on keywords that were close to how they defined, or the definition they used for gamification and serious games. They pointed this out already in the methodology section. As well as the use databases, which was limited, and the selection criteria we talked about earlier. Then they also point out that they had a fairly low number of studies, with many of them low quality, which obviously also affects the quality of their results in this paper. And then generally concluded well that they they see some trends and possibility for positive effects of serious games and the gamification in this domain, but they don't generalize anything. And they state that this is a good foundation for future work, which I think is quite well wrapped up. So this really states a good foundation, so you can really well see what actually has been done, how these papers have been found, what are the areas of improvement, and what has not been done so well. So, for example, they bring out that many of the studies did not really follow up in long term, mostly short term right after the intervention. And the papers who did actually check some long term behavior change, they didn't really find any influence with the intervention. So mostly with all the long term follow ups, the energy conservation did not hold up. So that's what they really suggest for future work to do, is more long-term research on the field with better data collection. And as I talked about earlier, I think this paper, it had a really good structure, so it was easy to follow and you could see what has been done. And even though it had quite a few limitations, they really picked them out well. That's all right. That's it. Next. So you mean about half the papers were low quality?
Yeah.
Bring it in. Yeah, that's what actually I was also wondering. So, but what they did, they had to do the review protocol beforehand. They actually reviewed the papers, so they had a process of how to select the papers. And they followed this one to gain the papers. And then when they actually did the data extraction, looked at the results, then they realized that, okay, these are low quality, these are high quality. So they didn't change their protocol during their process, which I think was good. But also having those low quality papers means that the results they have are also low quality. But what I think they did well when they presented the results, they often showed that, hey, these are some of the results, but they're from these low quality papers. And the high quality papers give these results. So they also separated them during the analyzation and discussion phase. Yeah, I think the best ones, which measured the effect with the actually the electricity readings with the metering systems. But there's also, you have to have some consent to actually take this reading from the households, and you can't keep it there forever. And that also, if you ask the consent, that also might change their behavior when they know they're being measured, which I think is a challenge. But I'm also thinking that the when you ask, for example, consent to measure the electricity usage, it might be that the behavior changes for the following week. But then, as you can't really see that anyone's measuring you, it might be that they forget it and they go back to normal. And that's, I think, it would be interesting to look at the when it begins, is there a different trend? And then does it go back to their normal level? Can you see this difference? Which I think could be a way to maybe solve it. Yeah.
Even without motivating some if I just put up on a Blackboard, they've done this impossible thing that you put up a list of the kind of number of catheters used or something, right? So anytime you put up a measurement and then update it regularly, people will start changing their behavior based on that measurement, right? You don't have to say, we want to use less of this or we want to use more of this, or like, things will change because you're showing them a number.
The feedback.
Because I know it costs me money, there is very definitely an incentive to lower that number, right? I had a discussion with a student when I was actually first started lecturing in Norway on Git repositories, right? So they were using Git down in Agder, but because they hadn't been told what was considered good behavior in Git, the clients had created its own value on number of commits, and they wanted to have the fewest number of commits by the end of the project. You know, no number is no good number, it's not gold. we're the lower the number, the better. But then, you know, if you put up number of commits this week as a number, and say, you know, we'd like a good number of commits, suddenly you get people committing every couple of minutes, your numbers jump up. Quality doesn't improve. They're just playing with a number, right? And that's one of the significant challenges with any time you measure someone and get feedback around that measurement is how much do they change their behavior? What objectives do they create around that measurement? I think you're right. And the long term was for things like behavior change, that is one of the challenges, right? So if you are if you're doing rehabilitation, then if you only change behavior for ads and weights, hopefully you'll rehabilitate the problem. Right? So the short term duration is fine for rehabilitation. But for energy consumption, it's a lifestyle change. And so these are quite different.
Yeah. And I also think it's interesting that I've read quite a few of the papers, and none of them really talk about habit creation.
Yeah.
Which I think, long term behaviors, their habits. And I think they should look into some literature of how could you use games and serious games to help create habits. So even after they stop playing, they might have this habit which is like an automated behavior. Yeah.
I don't know as a company if you plan to be around, like when you make a game, you go, I'm going to support this game for 5 years and update it every few months to keep people engaged. That's a massive commitment to energy consumption, right? So my question though, right, can be answered to, so this is a leading question rather than an exploratory question. Why do you believe that they only run up by energy? What do you think is the reason why they're such short durations? Right? So there's a master student working on a specific time. Right? It could be related to a course which was quite limited. Some of these are done by researchers. So.
Could it be related to seasonal changes with the different?
So what my experience of this sort of research is usually it's funded. Right? So the way that the American system works, and certainly the way a lot of your European system works as well, is that you apply for research funding. Right? And if you don't have funding for research, you don't do research. Right? Funding agencies grant funds for a specific time. Right? So we know this is a 3-year project. you kind of, if your 3-year project takes you a year to hire someone, you know, with your PhD, you do a review of the state of the art, you start developing your system, you've then got maybe 6 months test window for implementing and testing your system, and then you're writing for the next. Right? So in your 3-year thesis, you've got this 6 month from when your game is complete to when you have to finish data collection so you can write that. So all the studies go, well, we started here, we were able to track for this long, and we were able to then record for here, and then we had to stop. Right? So 8 weeks follow-up is kind of in that, oh, well, this is our semester, right? That is our 6 month period that we had to get enough people planning and then do a follow-up, right? So if you did an 18-week follow-up and they've done it for 6 weeks, then you're 24 weeks, which is your 6 month period, so and here you go. Right, so often this is related to funding cycles and duration. And the challenge is when you have short duration funding cycles and competitive funding, where they bring up funding each time that we need to be funding people. Long term, unless you get the funding for not doing something new, just checking to see if something you've already done has worked, that's just really hard to get funding for. Right? It's like getting funding for replicated research, which is we know we're supposed to do. And one thing I like about the paper, as you said, is it's very clear. Right? So the ability to replicate it. So do you think you'd be able to get similar results from reading the ability of this paper?
Quite close, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So you felt most of it was not subjective, right? There are a few subjective bits about quality.
Yeah, I think the quality one was the most, yeah.
Yeah, the most subjective. But the process is relatively clear, right? And so for repeatability, this is the kind of thing we want you guys to be able to kind of aspire to in a sense of how do we make what I thought was as repeatable as possible, right? And by having a clear process and by having a clear, like, each step being clear what will be done. That makes repeatability more likely. But getting long-term funding for that long-term and then repeat this and review it later, those are very difficult. And it's a curse of the kind of modern way of competitive funding and not just funding for long periods of time, one activity. The second, just creation, so one is funding something. What's another one where you might not see the long-term follow-up? If people move on, another possibility.
So
you're valuing doing new research over what doing follow up on previous research.
Yeah.
Right? That's a potential there. What's another reason why, now, I mean, what I said is why you don't see the results? Why might not you see papers being published around the long-term effectiveness of these activities?
I don't know, they mentioned publication bias as one of the limitations, and I was thinking it might be hard to get significant results from the...
If you go and do a 6-month follow-up or a 1-year follow-up and you measure these people and you see they are absolutely no different to the standard population, right? Then you're publishing a paper saying, we went back out and reviewed this and our game was completely useless and had no purpose. Right? And you are still trying to get funding. And so there's both publication bias, right? So I've read a paper saying, yep, we didn't achieve anything, right? And the journal might say, well, you know, that's not particularly interesting. We might not publish it. So there's the publishers can say that's not particularly interesting. But there's also, and this seems a bit mean, a potential for a self-interested issue, right? Because if I'm a researcher...
Future funding for yourself.
Don't want to fund me to do the next one because I probably won't help. So is there a personal right around publishing your failure, publishing your own lack of ability to affect behaviour? And how does that publishing affect your chance of getting the next round of funding when they start saying, okay, we've got 20 proposals on how to lower energy consumption? These guys already said they don't work. So do I just skip over them and start looking at the other guys who are promising, you know, unicorns and fairy tales versus these guys? Well, we know that game didn't work, but our new game, that will. I mean, so getting out there and publishing your failures and highlighting that what you did didn't work is, you know, that's a significant challenge. Now, in the ideal world, one, yes, you would do this for ethical reasons. You would be, you know, own up to your failure and say, yeah, no, that was me. We failed, and we had no effect, but we try to get there, right? And the other people would learn from your failure, and you could explain why. But, you know, that would be the ideal world. That would be great, right? Unfortunately, we don't quite live in an ideal world. You didn't all thoroughly read this paper in my ideal world where everybody knew everything. So we're not living in an ideal world. So how do you, so the second level of slightly more ideal would be if independent researchers were employed to review this. Right? So what you do is, as part of funding, you say, in a year's time, we will get these independent people to come in and measure the effect from our target group. We'll keep all that material, we'll hand it over to those independent assessors, they'll assess our ability, and they'll publish it out, right? And they'll publish independently whatever they find, and we have no influence on them, right? So that would be, okay, yes, if I was perfectly ethical, I would always admit my faults, given we know that I can't really like that. Creating an independent organisation that would be great, but expensive. And what they've just done this for, I don't know if you've been watching any of the recent news, but 5 years ago they set up a replication study for the major articles in cancer research to see if they could replicate these foundational facts. And they had two of them not at all, one completely mixed and two were successful. So less than half of the ones they did, where they kind of tried to repeat exactly what the original research had done, just, you know, actually replicated it. The rest, not the result that you expect. Right? And it's kind of, that's really bad for research, right? And so, but that study, very expensive to do, right? Because you have to replicate anything, and all you're publishing is, if you find that it's true, all your publishers, or like the best you can say, yes, we followed exactly what they did, so read their paper, and we got the paper. That's a comment on the result, not really a whole new groundbreaking innovation, right? So that's where you get publication bias with the elite. So this kind of long-term study, there are those, I think those two reasons. One is there's just not funding to do that, and the people aren't finding positive results. There's two aspects of that, which is publication bias and personal bias. Publication bias, the publishers refuse to publish it because it's not interesting. And also, oh, I don't want to publish that, I have a complete value. Right? So yeah, I think those are probably significant challenges as to why you don't have problems. Okay, so any more? Good. Other questions, other thoughts? Yeah, so the question of how did they choose that?
Yeah, because there was, you know, might be Springer as well. I'm guessing if you don't have enough to pass.
Yeah.
So
it's
probably a bit of like duplicate between them and destroying the past.
It does take a little bit of time, but if you've got your list extracted, you can often do duplication of title, for example. If two papers have exactly the same title, they're probably the same paper, right?
Mm.
Not always guaranteed, so often you do, like, first author, and if you extract, let's say, a bit of history, you can often get things that, like, there are JavaScript processes that will look for duplicate articles and try and unify them into one. Right? Have that in where you found them. Right? So they tag them with where they're found. So there are ways of doing that. The convenient sample issue is also, you know, what databases does your university pay for? Right? So, you pay for the SMM and IEEE and Web of Knowledge, right? So you could use Google Scholar, right? So those would be four you could follow. And then try and extract the information from. You'll find that there'll be a massive amount of duplication, right? Across ACM, IEEE, Web of Knowledge, and Google Scholar. Right? Those, like, there'll be, like, you'll find papers in all of those. All four of them will have some papers in them. So yeah, usually people they provide some justification, right? But you've got to watch out that even sometimes when people make a justification, they do what we can users do, which is they make a decision and then find evidence to support the decision. Right? So the decision is made, oh, because that's the one we own. And then you say, it was chosen because it has the highest percentage of computer science paper. Right? Which isn't the real reason, but it's the justification which could have been the real reason. And you wouldn't necessarily know whether the justification they've written down was the inciting justification, the inciting the reason for it, or whether it's a post hoc kind of can we find a justification. Sometimes, like with the head-to-head computer science articles, you could say, well, okay, the reason why the university pays for that particular database is because it has the largest number of community sites. So although it's the convenience sample, we use it because it's the one we own. The reason why we own it is because it has the largest number of. So in that sense, it isn't a lie. That is the reason why you're using that one. It's just you didn't know that until now. Right? Yeah, you did a convenience thing and then you tried to find out why. Right? It's like you fall in love with someone and then you try and justify it. It's because she's pretty and got a conversation and we go well together and I enjoy the company, or you don't necessarily make those evaluations first and then decide, having evaluated all these features, now I love you. it seems to happen kind of all mixed up. Right? So extracting some of those, sometimes it's not entirely accurate. Okay. So in terms of the one versus two researchers. Okay, so this is four systemic reviews. One of them we talked about is if you're doing coding, right? When you're encoding things, if you have one person doing the encoding, you risk they miss something, right? Or you risk them having a systematic bias that skews your results, right? Which is why they often recommend that you have two people. Cost is that two people doing something, it's more attention. Researchers doing the same piece of research. I would have to go back and have another look at it. When they did have two, because they had two on the quality assessment. So how you average two people's quality assessments, there are many scoring mechanisms for that.
No, actually, I don't remember that one either.
So you can, if you and I are measuring quality, right? If I say, so you can take the max of the two of us, right? So if you say it's high quality, and I say it's low quality, we can take max, right? We could shift towards high quality. We could take the min, right? If either of us have a problem with it, then it drops down. We could try and do an average, and then what do you do if you only got categories like high quality, low quality, what's the average of medium quality, low quality? Is the average low quality? Is the average medium quality? Actually, you do a 1-5 system. And then you average, because if you give people 1-5 system, there are some people who will go 2-4 and won't give many fives and won't give many ones. Right? They'll just stick in the middle. Because it's not clearly terrible because it got published, right? So it's not a one, it's just not this is an amazingly excellent paper that is in Nature, right? So they say, well, that would be a 5. So they really only have a 2, 3, or 4 range. And then you get a paper which is a 2. One thing is a 3, one thing is 2. 2.5, that comes out, that helps. Right? So, and given that your range is that small, that's, you get a bunch of those things. And that resolving can skew the number that you classify as low quality significantly if you get a lot of the boundaries, right? And so, like, how you resolve those, what that resolution was, how much disagreement there was between the two people. I usually use an average, right? So, you would an alpha. For most things, a 1 to 7 range is pretty good if you want to actually kind of get a bit more spread, right? But then, you know, squish off the 1 to 7, you've still got 5 here, but yeah, in the middle. So we usually do average, but there was one course when I was doing the exact where basically we were inverted. The external ranked all the ones that I ranked low, he ranked high, and I ranked high, he ranked low. And it was, the average means everyone's flat, and that's not what we felt about the week. So we did a max of each, right? Just because for that week, that felt like the right spot. Now, you need to have a process by which you make those decisions. And with you guys, when you are doing evaluation decisions, if you can get another master's student to share that evaluation with you, then you will get kind of, people go, oh, excellent, you had 2 people check, right? And it means that there is more work for you to do, but if you find someone who's doing something else that you find vaguely interesting, right, then you kind of do that for each other. And you can see right here, like, the large amount of work was done by an individual, which is probably passing your PhD student. The quality assessment, what you find is that someone else will also be working on energy consumption on a different PhD, maybe not using a GAN, but using or doing other interventions, right? And so there'll be overlap with the papers that person needs to read and the papers this person needs to read, right? So there'll be some that were outside the scope for each other, but they probably did that for each other, right? So I included a bunch of, if you're one PhD and I'm the other, I'll include a bunch of these in my PhD, you'll include a bunch of those in your PhD, but we're going to have to review them anyway, so we might as well both do the quality assessments and then allow ourselves to say 2 people to check the quality of the paper, right? And yeah, it means that there'll be 20 extra papers, 10 extra papers that I wouldn't have normally included, and the extra you wouldn't have normally included. So to get a second person to do all the rest, that's a win, right? So systematically, there's some of the things you guys need to think about as researchers. How do you get the maximum benefit from the work you do and by using other people? And so, I mean, one of the things that I want to do with you guys is why we have a deadline in April to give a draft, is that we can hand around each other and get feedback from the other students as to kind of progress and how you think. Okay, that's now 10 o'clock. Any other questions? Last question from me is, in terms of the process, as master's students, can you see how you reuse that process?
Yeah.
You could see how, if you're going to do a systematic review for your research project planning, to kind of understand an area that, you know, and one of the nice things about setting up like this, just for forward thinking, is that if you start working in an area in August, right, and you do this, you know, mid-August, by January, there may be more publications in the area you're interested in. Right? Now, if you've done a systematic approach, you can actually set those up as alerts and set those up as search strings, and so you can just rerun your search and get just the updates. Right? And so you can keep, so once you've set up the system, you can keep up to date with study hours more easily, because you don't have to go back out and try and work out how to find things and try and remember what string you use, and then you get a whole bunch of other papers, but then you don't get the one you're looking for because you remember there was this paper I read about this, and where was that again, right? And if you've not recorded your process like this, it's harder to go back and find it, the stuff down, save it, how you're doing your searches, and do kind of a be somewhat systematic, as systematic as you can be. Record those in your database searches, because you can do that in Google Scholar, you can, and Web of Science has an excellent service in there. And you guys all seen Web of Science? Okay. The university pays for this database, and it pays quite a lot of money every year for that, so that you guys have it. It has a save search notification system. So what you do is you save this search as a search string, and it generates all of those pages, so 2.5 hours. And then you can add in a notification section where if a new one gets added to that list, it will send you an email saying, oh, this one fits your search criteria. Okay? So it allows you to maintain kind of the state-of-the-art, the up-to-dateness of your material. And it will tell you, rather than you having to go and ask for which. If you look at, and I'll go meta here again, serious games, like the fog model of behavior change.
Mm-hmm.
So you have motivation, ability, and trigger. Getting the database to trigger you that there's a new paper in your area to read is a behavioral change trigger, right? Because you guys will want to be keeping up, but without the trigger to remind you to do it, sometimes you don't actually follow through, right? So when you set up that notification, you do want to set it up that it's reasonably tight, so that it's not spamming you every couple of days with massive number of papers to read, but you want it to kind of jog you to keep up to date with the research. Okay? So you can kind of think of how you use the tools to change your own behaviors around doing research. Okay? And we were just discussing that with Marish and Dippy. How we motivate you guys to do because a lot of you are interested in doing development work, right? Making stuff is engaging, but the research stuff is not engaging. So we need to perhaps do some more work on trying to find ways of motivating you to do the research material, right? And
or lower their ability. Yeah.
I thought this was reasonably well written. This was not.
But I have one question about the keyword selection for the searches. They didn't really talk that much about the process of how they selected the keywords. They said that they were based on the definitions they used for gamification and which they didn't use. And I'm actually not sure if they used, for example, serious games. But should there be some kind of pilot to test some of the search terms before and report it in the review? Or is it enough just to say what you ended up with?
It's enough just to say what you ended up with.
Okay, yeah.
Often there will be a pilot, right? You often will try something and see what you get out.
Yeah.
Right? And it may be that serious game gave you 10,000 or whatever. Just can't do that. So they limited it down that way. There is a significant challenge in different domains using different languages. And you mentioned that. This is a problem for a systematic approach.
Mm.
Engaging interactive simulation. they were filtering on the title. Now they weren't even reading abstract. They filtered on the title.
Mm. And the PC here seems not to be working, because when we go PC, it gives us no signal. It seems not to want to turn on.
Yeah.
So you're now still a keylogger on my machine.
Yeah.
I assume.
This paper is about the use and effect of video game design theory in the creation of game-based systems for upper limb stroke rehabilitation. Introduction. Strokes is the biggest disability or movement impairment disabilities in the UK, with about 150,000 strokes, first-time strokes every year, and 80 to 85% of all the affected gets hemiparesis, which is right or left body paralysis or movement impairments effects. The majority of the recovery is done within 6 weeks of the stroke, but hospitals focus on lower body improvements, which is walking and balance and gait, and often patients is discharged after only about 20 days to reduce costs. Yeah. So why serious games? Research has shown that games which include the upper body is effective for rehabilitation. Also cost, because it's very costly to keep many people on rehabilitation programs for 6 weeks when the rehabilitation requires a lot of time and repetitions, and by therapists, that cost would be huge. With a game, you can have it at home, and you can self-practice as much as you want. Also, games have concepts of motivation that will keep them playing for a longer period of time, rather than just doing exercises, which would be very boring after some time. Even though you should expect that stroke patients have some motivation to get better. Okay, commercial games. PlayStation iToy and Nintendo Wii and Fruit Ninja Leap Motion. There have been some research done on these game systems, and one study was on PlayStation iToy. The playing group and the watching group, about 30, I think it was 30 participants. One group split in half. One group was playing the game, and one group was watching the game. And they show some improvements in the playing group, showing that the game actually helped rehabilitation for the stroke patients. Also, a study was done on Nintendo Wii, And the study showed that these sports significantly improved rehabilitation in stroke patients. The studies might not be as good, and the one other study on Nintendo Wii Sports, which was more controlled and a better study, showed some improvements. So, yeah. Fruit Ninja Leap Motion, which is a VR systems, so they found improvements in hand ability and grasp force in the patients. Okay, so commercial game design concepts. To motivate players to play the game more, one must implement meaningful play and feedback, which means that when you interact with the game, you get some feedback from the game, that when you do action, you get something in return. You also should have goals and rewards. That means when you succeed in something, you get something back, like a score or a trophy or something like that. Also, challenge and difficulty is important to keep them interested and challenging them both cognitively and physically. Custom games. This is games focusing on rehabilitation that has implemented some of the concepts from commercial games. Rehab Master is a Korean game developed with patients that have suffered stroke, occupational therapists and physiotherapists. The game was played with a physiotherapist at the computer, so the physiotherapist could control the game while the patient was playing, so they could change the game difficulty as the patient was getting better or having trouble with doing the game. Message in a Bottle is another game which uses haptic feedback and virtual method for picking up a bottle, and they have you have a bottle coming to you, and you pick it up. You get one of 300 questions, and you have to choose if you will put it in the right or left bucket. This enhanced both cognitive practice and motion, because you had to pick it up. The problem: most stroke patients is elderly, and that might be a problem when it comes to games. And I don't know where they got the scales here, but they have found satisfaction points and stroke rehabilitation points. And for the elderly, chess scored 100% in satisfaction, but only stroke 20% in stroke rehabilitation. And Whack-a-Mouse, which is the game when you punch a mouse coming out of the hole, scored only 50 stroke rehabilitation points and 50% satisfaction points with elderly, and 80% stroke rehabilitation points. So getting the elderly more motivated by games might be tricky. The researcher went through 8 other researchers' work and found which features that most motivated the players. And the top five was socialization, motivational feedback, adaptability to motor skill level, challenge, and simple interface. These are features that absolutely should be implemented in custom games for improving motivational or motivation for playing the game. The author was very cautious in concluding any the specifics, but he saw encouraging evidence that games could be powerful in a therapeutic tool. He realized that most of the studies was low quality because of low participants and there was a few reasons too, but there was low quality because there were very low participants in the studies that he reviewed, and he said that more research must be done to have any real evidence on the topic. A little disclaimer is that Oddstock Medical Limited is a funder of the project, and they work with rehabilitation and specifically electronic rehabilitation. Also, the main author, Nathan Barrett, is a PhD student at the BU, but part-time he works at Oddstock Medical. Also, two of the supervisors for the project was working at Oddstock Medical, and only one was independent from the funding organization. So the results should be taken with a grain of salt. Or
it raises the issue of commercial funding of research.
Yeah.
But so Bournemouth has an industry PhD program, right? And so they have a large number of students who are working for a company while doing their PhD. So yes, but it usually the companies are not trying to convince the public of something.
You see that in the conclusion, he's not saying that yes, games is working. He's very
yes, my game is working. You're not playing.
Yeah.
although it does raise those concerns, the principal investigator, so Christoph there, is in charge basically of trying to make sure that there is effective and clean academic values for work being done individually or for funding.
Yes, thank you. Yeah. I think the aim of the study was in the title, the effect and the use and effect of video games design in creation of game-based systems or upper limb structure rehabilitation. So the goal was to find the effect and the usage of video games or the concepts in video games to see if it can help stroke patients in the rehabilitation program. I feel like the whole research paper is pretty messy. It's not a good structure in it at all. Yeah.
I thought it into the other one and then jumped on it.
Sometimes they can even do that to you, specifically to try and highlight like a formal systematic approach and a kind of, and you're right, I think, like for me, that question of what is it exactly trying to protect and use and effect.
They didn't really answer in a good way either, so. Probably. That's true. Yeah. So what I understood was that commercial games is for the public and like everyone can buy it, but custom games is specifically made for a course of rehabilitation. Yeah, I agree that that's a weakness. But I think they have a good point in taking these concepts into the rehabilitation games. But the hard part is motivating the user group that is elderly, because seldom I see that people or elderly play games at all. So I think I wouldn't get my grandmother to play a game.
Thank you.
If you were considering a category of me,
that's you're it. And so I there are days where I find that thing and then don't put it. So necessary and sufficient. So for defining whether a feature in a game is necessary for it to be a good game, you need to look at what considering the game and say, okay, are there anything in here that doesn't work? And if you say it's sufficient to do these things, right? So it may be a group of things that it's like a sufficient condition is you have A, B, C, and D, that bind is sufficient, right? So you could do that in an get it. They don't really do either of those things, right? They just say, oh, yeah, we analyze some of these, they had some of these features, we analyze some of these, we can also identify those features in the end. What is critical for me in this area is also the problem of identifying the ones that don't. Can you find bad games that tick all of these boxes? And you say, it's a terrible game, no one uses it, and you tick all of these boxes, which would suggest that you do all of these things, you'll end up being a good game. There's kind of that suggestion in there. Right?
Yeah.
That if we apply these design principles, then it'll be done better. Right? The answer is, well, find me games where you've done all of those things and they're still a terrible game. And that's saying that that's not sufficient. Right? That is not enough. There needs to be more before you create a sufficient condition to get it. Okay, so that's necessary. The last concept that I was going to add as a new concept to you guys, I don't know if you've heard it elsewhere, is hygiene factors. I think I've mentioned hygiene factors, which are around satisfaction. No, the original concept is satisfaction of business, but in this concept, in this context, you could suggest that interactivity was a hygiene factor, in that if I'm not interactive, right, then I'm not game. But if I'm more and more interactive, I might not be a better and better and better and better game, right? So you could look at some of the real-time strategy games, right? So StarCraft, where you're looking at actions per minute, and because it's micromanaging, the more actions you make, the better you are at the game, right? So for that, the level of interaction makes you better at the game. I don't know if it makes it a better game because it has so many required micromanaging directions. That's where it's all the not right. So it's not just that if you implement each one of these, if you add more of it, you increase in quality. It's not a kind of linear relationship between these things and goodness. Right? But yeah, so those are three concepts you guys should to think about: necessary and sufficient, and hygiene, whether it's a linear relationship. The amount of this thing and quality.
So, one thing that so they're talking about the implementation, but they focus a lot on motivation and increasing the motivation to pay as much as possible. So I'm thinking then again, do you think that for rehabilitation is important that also humans are performed correctly and just increasing motivation about hours, there might be quite a degree of capacity as well. It's wrong and so I think taking off on that and getting to the right.
Yeah, there should probably design that implements a therapy session alike game experience, because if you're just doing this all over, you might not get your feelings or movement in the correct parts of your arm or
rehabilitation benefit of that is also questionable because line over the wing, rather than actually doing the exit, you're often more.
Yeah. I want to comment on that. In Fruit Ninja, they found a correlation with higher score in the game and better rehabilitation, because I think Fruit Ninja is like dropping fruits and you are shopping them. Yeah. So, so your arm is everywhere, I guess. No, it's probably bigger muscles and easier to
falls, right? Because falls is a big medical category, and so falling over is what they consider the big problem, and so they try and get you to be stable, right? The fact that you can't feed yourself, that's your own problem, but if you fall over, that's a thing that they measure, right? So hospitals in the UK measure number of falls. Yeah.
Make an amazing game,